This is Indian Country, land of the Ottawa, the Chippewa, the Menominee, the Potawatomi, the Miami. Here, too, to the east dwelt the first great tribes of the Algonquin and the fierce Iroquois. These were the woodland Indians, living their ancient and generally peaceful way of life in an untamed wilderness. Where did they come from? And what connection did they have with the cross in the woods? Going back in time to an age now obscured by the passing of countless generations and thousands of years, when the first Stone Age ancestors of the Indians came across the ancient land bridge from Asia, pursuing the huge deer and bison straying into the mainland of the North American continent. This has been Indian Country. Across this isthmus lumbered the huge woolly mammoth, recording its ancient trail for the paleontologist by its large tusks, which are unearthed today as fossils. All the way from Alaska to over 150 locations in Michigan. Great deer, giant ground sloths, and bison made their way into North America. And in turn, the Paleo-Indian, too, followed that same ridge of land under the threshold of this continent. The earliest Indians journeyed between 10,000-foot-thick glaciers as they made their way southward and eastward, seeking warmer climes and following the game trails in their quest for food. The Paleo-Indians, migrating into the eastern area, evolved into the woodland Indians, where they became the Algonquin Indians. These nomadic people roamed the eastern woodlands for centuries before the aggressive Iroquois moved up from the south. When the first Europeans came into this country, they found the forest inhabited by two great divisions of the red race, the Algonquin and the Iroquois Indian nations, two great contenders for tribal supremacy. Traders and explorers found Indian country fabulously rich in furs, with the Indians friendly, eager to exchange furs for almost anything the white man had to offer. Over the rivers and forest trails passed explorers, hunters and traders, soldiers and adventurers, officials and surveyors, pioneers, families, missionaries, and the famous Courier des Bois, the forest runners, the light-hearted voyageurs. The dark and brooding forests of Indian country in those days rang with the songs of voyageurs as their heavily laden canoes surged through the rapids, along the silent waterways of this vast wilderness. The descendants of the early voyageurs are the ones who populated this Indian country, then and now. In all of the activities of man in this area, some came with visions of power, conquest, and territory. Some came with visions of profits, wealth from furs, trading rights, timber, copper, iron. And others came seeking homes for their families, land, security, freedom to worship. All of these people came to Indian country with their visions. But central to all of these visions was the vision of faith, the faith carried by the men of God. They were the ones who went ahead of all the others, teaching the Indians, helping them, caring for the sick, giving them hope, and furthering their naturally peaceful ways. In those days, these men of God did many things. They were pathfinders, explorers, mapmakers, scouts in the wilderness. Along with preaching and teaching, they recorded tribal legends, wrote Indian dictionaries and grammars, translated the Bible into Indian language. They reported copper discoveries, recorded lakes and river currents, the locations of capes, bays, and islands. They had a zest for exploration and discovery, as well as for spreading the word of God. Primarily, what these men were doing was trying to spread the message of the redemption an understanding of why Christ came to earth. He came to instill the idea of brotherhood, a sense of unity, of oneness, of personal dignity and individual worth, that from prehistoric man on down, regardless of race, creed, color, status of birth, or position in life, we all are men. Man, or mankind. In a word, they were trying to spread a sense of community. That Christ died for all men, not just the Frenchman or the Englishman or the Americans or any other self-chosen group of people, but for all men. The reason why we have our personal dignity is because we were created by God as individuals, and Christianity taught personhood. Up until the time of Christianity, things like slavery, oppression, wars, were very much a part of history, a way of life accepted and approved. This just naturally led to social orders of so-called superior beings and inferior beings, masters and slaves. The reason why Christianity made a contribution to the welfare of mankind was because it taught that a man had individual worth. He was a person. This individual dignity of the human being is a concept and idea that, in human history, first received solid basis in Christianity's teaching about the redeemed spirit of man. It is intimately connected with the creation and redemption of man. This, then, was the vision, the message of the redemption, which the missionaries of old tried to carry into Indian country. That Christ was a loving God, not a fearsome, vengeful God who had to be appeased, feared, and placated with bloody sacrifices and self-torture. There was no need ever to despair. As a revelation of the Great Spirit, Christ was a gentle God who brought the reality of forgiveness easily given, of hope ever present, and a bright future in the man's life. Yes, this was the message in the vision the black robes carried into Indian country. As, for example, when the two Jesuit fathers, Isaac Jogues and Charles Rainbold, first came to the river that links Lake Superior and Huron. Here at the rapids, which they named Sault de Sainte Marie, the Falls of St. Mary, they offered the first Mass ever held on Michigan soil. It was also the third Mass held in the entire continental United States. And they established a mission here at the Sioux in 1641. Other brave pioneers followed them and became part of the rich history of Indian territory. Later, St. Isaac Jogues was martyred near Auriesville, New York, by the fierce Iroquois. The great Father Marquette, whose first permanent wooden structure is a stockade and chapel, founded the city of Sault Ste. Marie in 1648. Sault Ste. Marie is the oldest city in Michigan and the third oldest continuous settlement in the United States. In 1671, French explorers claimed possession of the whole interior of North America, from Montreal to the South Sea, for Louis XIV of France. As 2,000 Indians representing 14 tribes from the deep north and west gathered by the foaming rapids of the Sioux and listened. A few years later, in 1673, Father Marquette joined the explorer Louis Joliet on an expedition, which ended in the discovery of the great river which the Indians called Mississippi, the Father of Waters. Father Marquette's final resting place is here at St. Ignace, where by his own request, he wanted to return to his little chapel by the straits. He was buried here by his Indian friends. In 1678, Father Louis Hennepin discovered Niagara Falls, called by the Indians the Thunder of Waters, one of the greatest natural spectacles of all time. Antoine Cadillac, who with 50 soldiers and 50 settlers built a fort at the site of Detroit between Lake Erie and Lake Huron to block the English from access into the upper country. Pontiac, war chief of the Ottawa, who inspired the greatest Indian uprising in America, in an effort to help the French regain their lost wilderness empire. Old Fort Michilimackinac, site of many battles, shifted its position many times in the early wars, being at different times French, Indian, English, and American. Yes, Indian country rings with the romance and adventure of names and events from a rugged past. And this is Hiawatha country. According to Indian legends and folklore of the Chippewas, Lake Superior is the Gitche-Gumee, the shining big sea water of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's world-famous epic poem, The Song of Hiawatha. Beautiful Tequamenon Falls on the Tequamenon River, which empties into Whitefish Bay on the lower end of Lake Superior, is where Hiawatha built his birch bark canoe and lost his friend, Kwasind. These beautiful falls are second only to Niagara Falls in the Great Lakes region. Hiawatha himself was a Mohawk Indian, a leader in forming the powerful Iroquois Confederacy of the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, and Senecas. Called the Five Nations, the Iroquois dominated all the other tribes in this northeastern part of the country around the Great Lakes. The peaceful, stately Algonquin prayed to be spared from the powerful Iroquois. When the stars are right, they say, one can still hear phantom war drums along the Mohawk and see sinister smoke signals speaking the Iroquois code across the valleys. The Indians of the Five Nations were called Iroquois by the French because they ended all their conversations with the words Hero, I have spoken, and Koi, which means with joy or with sorrow, according to the tone of voice. They also were called the Haudenosaunee, people of the Longhouse. Over 125 feet long and 25 feet wide, with double-deck interiors, these long cabins held as many as 20 families. Living in communal style, five fires to a longhouse, four families to each fire. The families sat on the bare floor, or on mats, or the skins of animals. Great diplomats and great warriors, the Iroquois frequently fought the stately, peaceful Algonquins. Captives often were adopted into the tribe. And so it was, over 300 years ago, at Osornenon, the easternmost village of the Iroquois Indians in the Mohawk Valley, that a young Indian girl, Tekakwitha, was born in 1656. Only a few years before, St. Isaac Jogues, a Jesuit priest, was martyred by the Iroquois at the same village, now known as Oriesville, New York. Her mother was a Christian Indian of the peace-loving Algonquin tribe. It is known that her name was Kahinta, Flower of the Prairie, and she was a captive of the Iroquois. Her father was Kinaronqua, a proud Mohawk chief of the fierce Iroquois. The name Tekakwitha means she who puts all things in order before her. A terrible smallpox epidemic swept through the village in 1659. When it had spent its fury, Kahinta and Kinaronqua and Tekakwitha's baby brother were cold in death. Tekakwitha was 4 years old, and from the time of the pestilence, she was to be pockmarked and her vision almost destroyed. She was adopted by her uncle, Ansigango, who resisted Christians in the black robes, as the Jesuits were known. Although Tekakwitha lived in some seclusion because of her disfigurement and poor vision, she was brought up to do all the things that Indian girls are supposed to do. Work in the cornfields, sew and mend, cook. Time went on. As peace came between the Mohawks and the French, more of the black-robed Jesuit missionaries came to the village. Tekakwitha, inspired by memories of her gentle Christian mother, asked to know more of the Christian God that was the God of her mother. At 18, she was baptized, taking the name Kateri, or Catherine. Kateri's life was a hard cross to carry after her baptism. There was outright opposition to her in the practice of her faith, and she suffered much. She was forced to flee to La Prairie, near Montreal, Canada. where the Jesuits had established a mission for Indian Christians like her. It was in darkness before dawn of a November day when she slipped away with an Oneida chief and a small group also going to the mission. Here she grew up, teaching children, caring for the elderly, the sick, leading a life of service to others, and dying at the early age of 24 on April 17th, 1680. Within moments after her death, Father Peter Sholinek, one of the mission black robes, testified that her face lost all traces of illness and seemed to become very beautiful and fair. Yes, the story of Kateri Tekakwitha is that of an Indian girl whose young life, though short, had a tremendous impact on those around her. Her gentle and courageous spirit, plus a life of giving of herself to others, were an inspiration to all who came to Indian country. Over 300 years ago, Kateri's favorite devotion was to build stick crosses in the woods. And while the crosses were for Kateri's own meditation as she prayed, she left them behind her as stops or stations, as reminders for others passing through the woods to spend a moment in prayer. In her own way, by personal example, Kateri Tekakwitha helped renew the spirit of passers-by, elevated their hopes, helped inspire a deeper sense of community, the key to real brotherhood. She helped spread the message of the redemption in her own small way. This, then, was the beginning of the story of the cross in the woods over 300 years ago. Today, again deep in this woodland Indian territory, far up in the north country of Michigan's lakes and forests, stands another cross in the woods. A beautiful shrine dedicated to the memory of Kateri Tekakwitha, who manifested the true spirit of Christianity in her short, courageous life of service. But it's more than a shrine to a young Indian girl. Above all else, it stands as a magnificent symbol of the oneness of man, of the personal dignity and individual worth of each separate human being, of the redemptive message of Christianity, that Christ died for all mankind. Because the redemptive message does apply to all men, it is the hope of all mankind in its search for fulfillment. It is universal in its appeal, almost as if it were part of a great design, a special purpose. This tremendous cross in the woods has become the focal point of many streams of consciousness, happenings in different times, in different places, in different ages, bringing together many people, bearing mute testimony to things long past. Yes, a great many events and happenings all come together for a deeply religious, educational, and important experience for visitors of all faiths. Here, the Spirit of Christ and the Spirit of Kateri Tekakwitha permeate the atmosphere. How did this shrine come to be? Because once again, a man of God had a vision. Father Charles D. Brophy. Like the missionaries of old who came into Indian country spreading the message of the redemption, he too came spreading the message of the redemption. He thought that here in Indian country, he too, like Kateri Tekakwitha did over 300 years ago, would plant a cross as a reminder to those who came this way to pause and spend a moment in prayer. Father Brophy knew that thousands of people would return to Indian country, not seeking furs or copper or timber or conquest, but a renewal of spirit. He knew that when people came to Indian country to be recreated physically and mentally on vacation, to renew themselves in the struggle of life, they could renew the vision of their dignity, of their origin, of their attitude toward others, of their understanding of community and brotherhood, by being reminded of the redemption and meditating on its message. So, once again, a black robe planted a cross, Only this time, it was the world's largest cross, unparalleled anywhere on Earth. He planted it for the red man, the white man, the brown man, the yellow man, for all men. Because that is the meaning of the redemption. Impressed with the natural beauty of the area, Father Brophy visualized a church which would inspire residents and travelers in their worship, aided by their contemplation of God's handiwork of sky, water, and trees. As Father Brophy often told his people, Christ himself preached his world-changing sermons beneath open skies, in meadows, along mountainsides, and on the shores of the Blue Lake of Galilee, often from a boat. However, his first project was the building of a church. Consistent with his dreams of a future shrine, this unusual but beautiful chapel was designed along the motif of an Indian longhouse, the heart of the Indian village, to remind worshipers of the closeness of nature. The Indians' approach to God was through nature. For this reason, Indians probably came closer to God than many learned men who have lived in libraries studying theology. From the donations of visitors of all denominations, non-Catholic as well as Catholic, short-term vacationers as well as transient tourists, and summer residents, piles of stone soon took the shape of a church. Strikingly beautiful in its woodland setting, the new church became known as the Church in the Woods. The first Mass in the church was offered on Memorial Day in 1949. On that day was voiced the hope for an outdoor amphitheater and altar, a sacred place that would be dominated by a massive cross soaring heavenward, a cross that might become a focal point for all of Indian country. This was Father Brophy's dream. When the faith and generosity of thousands of people made it certain that the cross would become a reality, construction of Calvary Hill began. From the world's greatest and oldest trees, the giant redwood, one was selected, whose age dated back over 2,000 years, long before the time of Christ. It was a mere seedling when Alexander the Great started his world conquest. It witnessed the beginning of the Christian era, wherein man found new hope in the message of the redemption. It witnessed historical events in which man, long under the bonds of slavery, took the first steps toward freedom and independence. The Magna Carta, the Crusades, the founding of the United States. New freedom of speech, freedom of belief, political freedom. How very appropriate that from one of God's biggest and oldest living trees, one should be selected to make the largest cross in the world. From one of the greatest living things to make the greatest symbol of eternal life. It wasn't until 1954 that the great cross was raised to its place on the hill. And what a magnificent and inspiring cross it was. 55 feet high, 5 1/2 stories high, 22 foot wide crossbeam, and it weighed 14 tons. For 5 years, from 1954 to 1959, the gigantic cross stood as an impressive symbol of the Christian faith to all those who came into Indian country. Meanwhile, Marshall Fredericks, the internationally known sculptor, found his greatest challenge in the design of the figure of Christ for the cross. 31 feet tall, 23 feet between the outstretched hands, 7 tons of bronze. The gigantic figure had to be specially cast in Oslo, Norway, then shipped to the United States, and finally transported to the Church in the Woods by truck. In 1959, the task of affixing the heroic-sized bronze corpus to the redwood cross that had so patiently awaited its precious burden took 11 hours of painstaking work under the personal supervision of the sculptor. One very noticeable feature of this figure of Christ is that it has no crown of thorns. One legend has it that it was lost on the way to Calvary.
Representations of the crucifixion in the early Christian centuries portrayed Jesus without the crown. The sculptor chose not to include a crown of thorns in his representation in order to give the face an expression of great peace and strength. The first sight of it was breathtaking and awe-inspiring. The magnitude of the crucifix truly emphasizing the greatness of Christ's sacrifice. During the years that followed, the work of building and beautifying the shrine continued. A beautiful outdoor altar was installed, featuring deep green granite in the altar, pulpit, and retaining walls. 52 granite posts with bronze rope encircle the church area, each with a donor's dedication to a favorite saint. Thousands of people come to attend Mass each Sunday during the summer months. The holy stairs are an outstanding feature of the shrine, with 28 steps patterned after the original holy stairs Jesus ascended during his passion while proceeding to Pontius Pilate's praetorium. A relic of a saint is sealed in each step rise. The wooded area of the shrine lends itself perfectly to another beautiful feature. Beneath the many boughs of the tree-bordered path are erected the hand-carved stations of the cross. At the shrine is found the lovely Carrara marble statue of the Madonna of the Highway. There could be no more fitting patron for vacationers, tourists, pilgrims, or travelers of any type. Enriching the spiritual mood and prayerful setting of the shrine is the inspirational music provided by the famed Schumerich Carillons. A large statue of Kateri Tekakwitha stands in a natural setting among pine trees in full view of the cross, which Kateri loved so much, worshipped, and suffered innumerable hardships for. Kateri Tekakwitha's practice of building crosses in the woods served as an inspiration for the shrine's Calvary Hill with its crucifix. When she attains official sainthood, this Indian River shrine will be dedicated to her, Kateri Tekakwitha, Lily of the Mohawk, who long ago built crosses in the woods in Indian country. Here is an Indian maiden who loved nature as God created it. How appropriate, then, that she be considered the patron of the Indian River Shrine. Yes, the spirit of Kateri Tekakwitha and the spirit of Christ permeate the atmosphere here at the shrine in Indian country. This is a hallowed place, a beautiful and serene place. The sky is the dome of the outdoor church, and the pines its pillars. The music is the song of many birds, the whispering winds, and the gentle swish of the lake's waves. Lovers of the outdoors are brought to a fuller realization of God's majesty at the altar of natural beauty. There have been thousands of people of all faiths who have come to Indian country on vacation to the shrine, seeking a renewal of the spirit as they recreated themselves physically and mentally. And here, as they pause to spend a moment in prayer, many have renewed themselves in the struggle of life, renewed the vision of their dignity, of their origin, of their attitude toward others, of their understanding of community and brotherhood, by being reminded of the redemption and understanding its message. Above all else, this heroic cross stands as a magnificent symbol of the oneness of man, of the personal dignity and individual worth of each separate human being, of the redemptive message of Christianity, which is that Christ died for all mankind. Because the redemptive message applies to all men, it is the hope of all mankind. And certainly, the little cross in the woods, placed there by the little Indian girl, is part of the great design which caused this tremendous cross in the woods to become the focal point for many people of all faiths to come together for a deeply religious, educational, and important personal experience. Yes, deep in Indian country, is the shrine inspired by Kateri Tekakwitha, of whom the Indians spoke. Onwianwiki, Katsisio, Tiatsit, Sianakeran, which, translated from the Iroquois, means the most beautiful flower that ever bloomed for the red man. This is the cross in the woods.